The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good morning. I'm Gary Thomas, a correspondent for Voice of America News. And I was supposed to make an administrative announcement about lunch, that immediately after this there will be sandwiches and lunch out in the foyer. Lunch will be till about 1:15, 1:30, so your presence is requested back here at 1:30. That's on the lunch item. Our panel is on covering the global war on terror. And I have three distinguished colleagues here who are going to try to help me tackle this subject. Starting to my right, we have Mr. Andrew Steele. Andrew is the Washington Bureau Chief for the British Broadcasting Corporation, which I have to say is something of my competition, at least when we're overseas. And actually, he runs the entire American News Bureau, which includes bureaus down in Mexico City, Buenos Aires, and Havana. Quite a bit of territory for him to cover. Nathan Gutman is the Washington correspondent for the Israeli daily newspaper, the Jerusalem Post, and he was previously the Washington correspondent for Haaretz. He's worked in both print and television media. And has his degree in contemporary Judaism from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. And Eric Scherer is the executive director for North America for the Agence France-Presse, AFP. He was previously the chairman of AFX News in London. He's worked overseas in work here. He's worked for Reuters News Agency as well. So, a brief bio. I'm Gary Thomas, and I'm a correspondent for VOA News. I work in Pakistan and South Asia and Southeast Asia in Bangkok, and I'm supposed to start by with the usual disclaimer that anything I say cannot be held or used against me since it's only my views and not that of the U.S. government or the Voice of America. In his classic Western, John Ford had his character who's played by Jimmy Stewart. He's a famed politician, and years later he's giving his reminiscences to a reporter. And in the course of this story, he tells the reporter that he indeed was not the person who killed off a very famous gunman many years before. And this was the incident that, of course, led to his political fame. And in the end of the interview, at the end of the movie, the reporter tears up his notes. And he says, this is the West, sir. When the legend becomes fact, print the legend. And that's one of the things I think we're confronting in covering the war on terror. What are we printing or broadcasting in terms of legend and in terms of fact? This is probably one of the most difficult stories I think any reporter has ever had to cover. It's marked by deep secrecy. It's a war fought in the shadows. And there's a lot of hype that has gone around this story as well. Certainly we all know about the weapons of mass destruction, which turned out, of course, not to be there. I think from a journalistic viewpoint, even more so was the story of PFC Jennifer Lynch, who was portrayed by the Pentagon as Rambo-esque, you know, bravely fighting off hordes of advancing Iraqi troops. And the truth was far less than that. And as a matter of fact, it was the BBC who did a great deal in debunking that story and bringing out the truth. So we have to get through layers of bureaucracy, and we have to get through layers of secrecy with an administration that is apparently obsessed with secrecy, even telling us that the printing of a story in the New York Times about a wiretapping project is screaming aid and comfort to the enemy. I think many of us question, well, you know, we assume that they know that they're being listened to, so why is that a great secret? I mean, I think there's a lot of argument about that particular issue, but the war on terror is also, in effect, I would say that using that term, even war on terror, is subject to interpretation. Now, I think many journalistic outlets prefer, especially abroad, prefer not to call it a war. Secretary Rumsfeld tried out a new term, the global struggle against violent Islamic extremism, not as catchy. And President Bush made his preference for the war term well known. He went right back to it, so that stayed on. American journalists rely on American sources. We have a lot of official sources that talk to us, usually on background, anonymously, because they're dealing in secret information. Foreign journalists have their own sources. They may not be American. They may be their own officials, officials of other countries. That's going to shape the perception of what you read and hear. And we wonder then, is there a nationalistic identity in terms of how the news is covered in this global war on terror, for lack of a better term? Coverage makes perception, but then perception makes coverage. You know, newspapers and radio and television are going to want to put out what their listeners or readers want to hear. So as we cover things in a certain way, then pick that are put out to the public, and then the public really decides, they are the filter, they decide what they want to hear, what they want to know. I think one of the extraordinary things, one of the sad things that has happened in this modern day age, is that with the advent in technology that we have had, that should make the job of news gathering easier, and in fact it has, yet organizations are cutting back on foreign news coverage across the board. Foreign news bureaus are being shut all over the place. They're simply deemed not cost effective by the bean counters in agencies, in news agencies. And as a result, the day of the real foreign correspondent is fast vanishing. When you had someone who went and lived somewhere for 5 or 6 years, maybe even longer, built up expertise, built up contacts, learned the language, and therefore when a story came along, they knew what was going on. That is dying out, and most news organizations now feel it's more appropriate just to parachute someone in very quickly and let them cover the story and then leave. So you have these sort of quickie journalists going in for a few days, a couple of weeks, covering the story and then getting out. So to deal with some of these issues, I'd like to turn to my colleagues, and I'd like to start with Andrew Steele. And Andrew, why don't you take...
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. When I was invited here, one of my colleagues wryly told me that addressing a room full of lawyers and soon-to-be lawyers would mean that I would be held here twice as long as I expected, and I'd suddenly find $2,000 missing from my pocket. So I hope that's not the case. I work for the BBC, which is probably something that is familiar to you, not least because we broadcast to the United States. The BBC is an odd beast in that we are mandated by the British government to provide news to the British public. But through the years, we've also developed an international service, which you see on PBS here, BBC World, which you hear through public radio as well. But that is only a small part of our remit, and I would ask you to bear that in mind about everything I say and about everything, any perception you have about the BBC. What you know of the BBC is only one small part of it. But that said, those of us who work in Washington, those of us who work in the Middle East, we have to work for all the BBC. And what we try to do is to give a view which is as objective and as independent as possible. In so doing, we have to try and cut through and debunk some of the myths which arise about any story, and not least about the war on terror. And can I take that point first? What is the war on terror? I mean, apart from... there was a cataclysmic day on September the 11th, 2001, when quite clearly the world changed, and the world changed in particular for Americans. But how did it change the rest of the world? Bear in mind that in Europe and in Britain, we've had our own war on terror, if you like, for decades against the Irish Republican Army. Bear in mind that in the Middle East, there have been ongoing feuds between Arab and Israeli, between Muslim and Jew for as long as, unfortunately, many of us can remember. So the war on terror was not something which started on September the 11th. So I think when we report on anything to do with this ongoing story, one must bear in mind that it did not start on September the 11th. It started years, decades, possibly centuries before that. I think that is something which I try to get my colleagues at the BBC to concentrate on, but I'm not sure that it's something that the American media have quite grasped. It still harks back to September the 11th, and I would venture to suggest that that is possibly a lot to do with the administration, which possibly mentioned, and your president, who mentions September the 11th in just about every speech he makes about the war on terror. Now, that is, he obviously has a political agenda, but when it comes to being a journalist, I think it's very important to remember that it didn't start there, and it's not going to end when the current administration leaves the White House, and indeed when America perceives the war on terror to be won. There's a lot more to it than that. It is a strand which disappears back into the mists of history, and which I fear will continue for a lot longer than we're around. So how do we deal with this when we're on the ground? First of all, we try to take, we, the BBC, and I should add the same rider that Gary did, that I'm speaking my own views tonight, today, rather than the views of the BBC. But how do we deal with it? We deal with, I always go back to the BBC guidelines, which is a sort of rule book for journalism, which you'll find on the website if you're interested. And the words independent, objective, appear liberally scattered there. That's the first thing. Do not take a we do not take a political agenda into the way that we report. This is not the same as many other of my European colleagues, because let's take the UK, Britain, which is the market I know best. Most newspapers there are owned by commercial interests, which means that they will spout a political agenda. We don't. We try not to. We get into trouble if we do. There are all sorts of checks and balances within the BBC and indeed outside the BBC to ensure that we are not sucked into any sort of agenda. The political aspects of reporting this story, however, are never far from the surface. If you think that Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister, he probably staked more in the war on terror than George Bush did. When Tony Blair took the United Kingdom into the war in Iraq, there was a perception, well, it wasn't a perception, it was there was a fact that there were hundreds of thousands of people marching in the streets of London and in other European capitals. So he took a great risk in supporting George Bush in the war on terror and, by extension, the war in Iraq. So this is in itself a story for us. But again, we cannot confuse the issues of Tony Blair and the issues of Britain's involvement with America in Iraq. We cannot confuse that with any sort of political agenda. And how do we do that? In many different ways. Of course, you get the balance from other political parties, which is very important. The terminology you use is something which is never far from the top of my mind. Possibly not because of the war on terror, but because I've just spent, before being here 6 months ago, I spent nearly 5 years as a bureau chief in the Middle East, based in Jerusalem. And my colleague Nathan here will also have his own stories to tell about the sort of terminology one uses when reporting on the war on terror. Words like terrorist, words like militant, words like war, they are tainted words, and therefore words that we tend to avoid. But because we avoid them, the very fact that we do not use them get us into trouble with other groups who think that we should be supporting their cause by using those very words. So we end up with this very strange and very difficult balancing act between the sides. In a way, it's easier for us because the BBC is there to espouse the balance between all sides and to expose all facets of the issue. It's sometimes more difficult for colleagues, some of my press colleagues in the United Kingdom, whose papers support one or other side of the conflict. When that is the case, they can find themselves getting into a great deal of difficulty in trying to be objective journalists, but at the same time getting pressures from their own newspapers. So it's a juggling act. Sometimes we drop the balls, but all we can do is to continue stressing these words of objectivity and lack of bias in the hope that in the end we are providing more light than heat into the debate. Thank you.
Nathan Gutman from the Jerusalem Post.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me over here. I'd like to talk a bit about the Israeli example in covering the war on terror. And when we talk about Israel, we don't usually use the term war on terror. We usually see it as a national conflict which has a lot of elements of terrorism in it. And it's, of course, different than the war the U.S. is conducting now. I'll try to touch upon the differences and the points of similarity between the way the media in Israel covers the war on terror and from what we see over here in the United States. Now, since 2001 to 2005, what the Israeli press did most of the time was cover terrorism, cover terror attacks. Luckily, we have a year of quiet now, but no one can be sure how long this will go on. But for those 4 or 5 years, the Israeli press was consumed by covering terrorism, terror attacks, response to terror attacks, counter-response, and so on. That was the major issue. So I think the Israeli press is in a way, an expert in covering terror attacks, but I'm not sure this was always taken to the right direction. I just try to outline what happens in an Israeli newsroom, whether it's in radio, TV, print, online, when we hear of a terrorist attack and how this rolls out and what is the product that finally we serve to our media consumers. Now, once you hear the first idea of a terror attack, and it happens many times, usually by a beeper of one of the correspondents, the wheels start rolling very fast in the newsroom. Correspondents are sent out to the scene. You have reporters, TV crews, broadcasting vehicles. There's this one thing that you see many times in Israel, you don't see usually over here, that we send reporters out to the hospitals to wait for the injured to come, for the ambulances to come from the scene. And this all goes very fast, and to tell you the truth, it's pretty mechanical. There's not much thought put into how we cover terrorist attacks. We all know what to do. The first sign of an attack, everyone knows his place, everyone's on his way to the scene, and things start rolling very fast. Within a few minutes, you see TV stations cut their broadcast and turn into a breaking news mode, which will usually remain that way for the rest of the day. Radio is the same thing. Newspapers won't have, of course, you don't have nowadays special editions, but the websites, the online editions will move into an emergency mode as well, an emergency format. So in 1 minute, the media goes into this emergency mode, and the whole country follows it in clinging to the TV set, to the radio set, and trying to figure out what's going on, where did the terror attack happen, who do we know that's over there. Now, the first thing that we're going to see on TV or hear on the radio in the minutes and hours after the terror attack is the eyewitnesses. It's almost a joke already. People joke about it there when they can. You hear people, this sentence going on, I was walking in the street and suddenly I heard this big boom, and that's a line that you'll hear. You probably heard it many times, Andrew, while you're over there. And then we go and we hear these eyewitness accounts of the events, which frankly don't give much information, because what do you know? What can you say when a bus goes up in flames? Yes, you hear a big boom. The second round will be, of course, the reports from the hospitals, from the injured, And then it goes to the wider circle of talking about the families, about the people killed in the terror attack. It's for someone looking from the outside, this might seem a little bit unsettling, the way that the Israeli media covers the terrorist attacks, the detailed account of exactly what went on in the scene, the TV shots of the puddles of blood on the ground, the lines of bodies covered with sheets. It is very disturbing, but in my opinion, that's part of the ritual that the Israeli public got used to and made the media get used to of dealing with the daily terror attacks. That's part of the ritual. That's part of the way Israelis learned to get over this situation that we're in the last 4 or 5 years. After the first phase of the coverage, we'll usually move over to a more analytical phase with the politicians swarming the TV studios with all kind of advice of what should have been done or why the government is doing the right thing or the wrong thing, depending on which party they come from, all kind of experts of what can be done and so on. And this just goes on for an hour with a whole nation sitting stuck to the TV screen, trying to listen just more and more, even though there is no information coming through. The main characteristic of the Israeli media's approach to dealing with the terror attack is the personal viewpoint. The reports will always deal extensively with the life stories of the victims. The newspapers in the day after a terrorist attack will be full of the stories, the personal stories of the people that were killed. Again, people joke about it already because it's so often, but you know, everyone was either, he was going to celebrate his birthday the next day, or she was on her way to a big test, or they said they had a bad feeling when they left home the same day. You always see these quotes and the pictures of the victims very largely in the papers the next day after a terror attack. Now, why is this coverage in Israel so personal? And I'll touch in a moment on why is it so different than the coverage over here. I think mainly because, first of all, it's a small country. Everyone knows everyone. Everyone in a country of 6 million people, 7 million people, you're always close to the people that were in the terrorist attack. There was a study done in Israel that showed that every 8th Israeli family, 1 out of 8 families in Israel, has a relationship with someone that's a terror victim of the last couple of years, which means that everyone is close to the events. Everyone wants to know. Everyone, if you hear that a bomb went off in Jerusalem, the first thing you do is rush to the phone and call the people that you know in Jerusalem just to make sure they're okay. If you hear a bus blew up in Haifa, you'll do the same, because everyone knows someone around it. It's a small country. Now, because the terror became a personal matter, because the daily fear became a matter that affects every Israeli in his daily life, the coverage also became very personal. Reporters weren't only covering the story, they were also part of it. First, because they have family, they have friends, they know people all over. You're not covering a war in a distant country. The people are over here. And second, because of the fact that you're there and you experience the horrors of the war. I personally know of a few friends, two of our best reporters in Haaretz, that left the profession after covering years of a terror attack just because they couldn't do it anymore. They said they just can't go to one more terror scene. One of them is now a documentary director, and the other one lives in India. They really couldn't do it anymore. I had once a friend working in Israeli television, which came back from covering a terror attack with his shoes covered with blood, and you know, that's part of it. The reporters aren't distant. They're part of the story. They're covering their country, their area, and they're really there. So it's very difficult to make the distinction between to take a step back and make the distinction between me as a reporter and the events going on the ground. Now, this is totally different than what we see in the U.S. media and the way it covers the terror attacks. And for me, as an Israeli over here during 9/11, it was surprising to see that we didn't see many personal stories in 9/11. We didn't see any scenes. We didn't see much blood in 9/11, which is good, I think, but it tells you something about the difference between the way terror is covered over here, when it's a big country and terror attacks are very seldom, and in other countries where it's a daily routine. you hardly see stories of the victims in terror attacks. The New York Times ran for a few months, I think, a couple of pages with small stories about the 9/11 victims, but we didn't see much more than that. Who knows who are the people that are being killed in Afghanistan and in Iraq? We don't hear their stories hardly. Now, what does this difference mean? It's not only a difference in the way that the press covers the event, it also reflects the way the people in the country perceive the war on terror. In the Israeli case, the war on terror, both when Israelis are being attacked or when they're responding to attacks, this war is seen as a matter that's close to every Israeli. Each and every Israeli feels the fear, and most of them identify with the causes of this war. Now, in the American case, it's different. The war on terror is distant. It's far away. Isolated attacks. The war is going on in distant countries, and I think the fact that in the military that's fighting this war is a professional military. There is no draft, so people can look at the Iraq war, the Afghanistan war, and say, well, these are Americans that chose to go there, so we'll see. It's not that kind of connection that we fielded, as in countries where the people being killed are really part of the people of the country. Now, there's one other point I'd like to touch on before we move on, and that's the role of the media and the way the war is really handled on the ground. Now, the Israeli media, when it came to covering the Intifada, chose, I don't know if it was aware of the choice that it's making, but it did chose to take a very dramatic tone in covering the event, a very personal tone, sometimes even a hysteric way of covering the event. If anyone would look at the big newspapers in Israel the day after the attacks, you had these huge red bold letters with only two or three words, like the horror on the bus, or how long do we have to live with this, or till when, things like that. There's no doubt that the Israeli press, print and electronic press, played a very important role in catering to what the public wanted to hear. The public was afraid, and so the Israeli press gave them some more fear. The public felt that there is no solution, and the Israeli press just went on to pursue this point. Now, this could have been done differently. You could have given your readers and your viewers more perspective, more depth, more analysis, and even sometimes more opinionated editorials, which would kind of take the other view. Now, of course, it's very difficult to do when your country's in a state of war and people are being attacked on a daily basis. People want to pick up the paper in the morning and look at it and say, well, oh, that's exactly what I feel, or yeah, they're right, that's what I think. But sometimes the role of the press is to say, well, maybe this is what you feel right now, but let's think of it in another way. Let's look at the other side. I'm not going to say here that there's any explanation for a terror attack or any justification, but if this is a conflict going on for years, and so you might want to deal with the question of why is it going on and what can be done. You can analyze the moves that your government is taking against the terror attacks. All this discussion was muted during the years of the Intifada in Israel because the media got the feeling that that's not what the people want to hear. The media, in the way, catered to the fears of the Israelis and did not discuss the real issues. Preferred instead of that just to give them more fear and more slogans about the enemy instead of really dealing with the issues instead. Now, I'd like just to conclude by saying that unfortunately I feel that is what's going on with the American press also this time. Of course, the volume is much lower in covering terror and in dealing with terror effects, but I don't think we are hearing yet the right questions and the answers from the media. Even now, 5 years into the war on terror, I'm not sure the press really questions even the title of it. What is the war on terror? How is it conducted? What do we know about Al-Qaeda? Who are these people? Are we winning the war on terror? Are we losing the war on terror? What should be done? This is dealt very marginally, and the main bulk of the coverage dealing with the war on terror is just the war itself instead of getting into the meaning of it. So I think, unfortunately, the same phenomena that we've seen in Israel is occurring again in the United States now. Thanks.
Eric Scherer from Agence France-Presse.
Hi. I will be much shorter than my colleagues to leave some room for question and answer. I'd like to address two topics. The first one is to, in the light of what was said before, to avoid some misunderstanding about my organization. It's Agence France-Presse is based in Paris, but we are trying, and I think we are a truly international organization. A little bit like the BBC we have heard before. We are newswire, like the AP, Associated Press, and Reuters, who are our main competitors. And it's very important to for the credibility of what we are trying to cover. For example, in Washington, we are nearly 60 journalists here covering the U.S. news, and with a team of people coming from 17 nationalities. This is the base of what we try to show how international the coverage is, how we try to be objective. And we have like the BBC or like AP or Reuters, we have people all over the world, and the people for whom we are covering it are also coming from all over the places. Our customers are not only French, they are French, but they are also from all over Europe, all over Africa, Asia, and in the US as well. And this is an interesting part of the last few years, where our audience in the US has grown, because we believe and we have noticed that the US public, through the internet, through the web, has a bigger and growing appetite for a more international point of view than what is in the US press. My second point is how we cover, very very concretely, how we cover the war in Iraq. We have an office in Baghdad, where we have 30 people. Again, we are covering the war in Iraq in three languages, in French, in English, and in Arabic. We always have three English people, English-speaking people there, and three Francophone to cover it, and we have a dozen of stringers in Iraq, mainly Iraqi people. We are not working inside the Green Zone, but we are outside in the center of Baghdad in a hotel. We are occupying a whole floor of a hotel where our people work, eat, and sleep there. It is very, very difficult to work in Baghdad these days. The work in Baghdad and the work in Iraq, and especially in the south, is every day more and more difficult. We have to hire security guards to travel. We try to have a low profile. We don't have big SUV. We have a normal car, and we have an armed escort to travel from the airport to the office, or to from time to time to travel in Baghdad or outside if possible. We have also embedded reporters with the U.S. and the coalition forces. I have to say that it works very well. We have, as a French organization, we didn't have any problem at all with the U.S. forces, and the U.S. authorities, the embassy is helping us when it's possible, and they have been a great help, because we had some problems here and there. There is still no press association in Iraq for foreign journalists, which is a big problem for the press to work. What I can tell you is that the reporters, the photographers, are sent in Iraq from all over the world, from the US, from Asia, from Europe. They are sent on a voluntary basis, and they work 6 weeks and in a row, and then they have a 2 weeks off back where they are coming from. So this is how concretely we cover Iraq, but again, it's every day more and more difficult for us to do our job. Thank you.
We'll open for questions now. I'd just like to get the ball rolling by addressing the question of American news coverage versus foreign news coverage. I think U.S. news organs have engaged in kind of a journalistic isolationism at this point, what foreign news organizations cover the United States far better and far more comprehensively than the United States news organizations cover the world. I think that our news organizations generally go when there's a disaster or some big story, but most of the time you see taken up on the news is not foreign news. And even an organization like CNN, there's a difference between CNN International and the CNN you see here. And the CNN International, it is far more international in scope than the domestic CNN we see here. So I'd like to throw that open. What do you fellows think about the question of American news coverage versus European news coverage?
I couldn't agree more. The American media, what we're talking about this morning goes far beyond any coverage of the war on terror. It is a general observation about how the world is reported in the United States. The BBC, AFP, Reuters, a multitude of organizations will invest a great deal of time, effort, and money in reporting the world. One of the reasons we do that is because there is an audience back home who is consuming this sort of material. And if you think of, I don't know, ABC's World News Tonight, to take one program out of the air, how much of that program will be to do with international news? Very, very little. Whereas if you were to take the equivalent BBC News broadcast going to a domestic audience in the late evening, you would get at least two stories from elsewhere in the world and possibly more than that. Sometimes the majority of that half-hour news broadcast will be international news if it's a busy day abroad. So that's what you have to wrestle with. It's not just how you report the war on terror, it's how you construct your news programs and the sort of interest which is engendered from international stories. I would very much like that agenda to be broadened for the American audience, because I cannot believe that there's not an interest out there.
I'd just like to add that other news organizations are closing their bureaus around the world all the time, and we keep hearing about the financial problems and how expensive it is to keep an office in Pakistan or in Israel or in Africa or anywhere else. But the fact of the matter is that, of course, we know American news organizations, they're making good money. It's a matter of priority. It's a matter of someone deciding that the audience at home would want you to have a chopper covering the local traffic, which costs tens of thousands of dollars, and not an office covering what's going on in Africa. And it's a matter of priority, not only of money, and I think that the viewers themselves are disadvantaged because of it.
Sure.
Just a few words as an observer. We were very surprised during the run-up to the war about the lack of maybe of investigation by the U.S. press, of the lack of in-depth analysis of the Middle East culture, and also the fact that the link between 9/11 and the Iraq war was not very much challenged, even by the political opposition until the very end of the campaign. I don't know. It's a question. Is it because of fear to be accused of being non-patriotic after 9/11? I think it's a big part of it. I don't know.
Some questions start over here.
Thank you. My name is Jefferson Castro. I'm a advocate of the United States Marine Corps. My question is for the whole panel, and it focuses on journalistic freedom that we recognize in the First Amendment, freedom of press, freedom of speech, balance against the responsibility of the press, particularly in wartime situation. Going back to World War II, we know the press sometimes didn't publish stories because they didn't have much of an effect on the war. I'd just like to role of the press and the responsibility of the press in the back of the
If I may start off, there are even cases now today where stories are withheld by news organizations on national security grounds. They feel that the publication would not be in the national interest. I think most news organizations are responsible in trying to assess those qualities of what's going on of national security versus the public's right to know. The problem we often come up against is that there's a great deal of official secrecy. And, you know, anybody wielding a classification stamp that says secret just puts a secret stamp on just about anything they think they deserves it. And is all that secrecy deserved? There was declassification of documents, and now we find that documents that have been declassified are now being pulled back out of libraries or archives and being reclassified. And we're talking about stuff that goes back 50 years. So there is going to be this constant tension over the question of secrecy. I do think most news organizations are responsible, but I also think that government has the responsibility of protecting legitimate secrets, but not using the secret stamp to hide misfaults or errors.
As a journalist, you want to tell the world as much as you possibly can about any story you're covering. But when it comes to military operations, when it comes to the potential of direct life or death, in my experience, which is in Africa, which is taking part in military operations in Africa and the Middle East, there tends to be a very high level of responsibility and cooperation between the military and, shall we say, the responsible and respectable media, all of which is represented here this morning. There will always be the bad apples who want to get the story come what may. But I have been out on assignment with on an embedded operation where we've been given the ground rules. You can report this, you cannot report that, you cannot report your specific location because that would endanger future operations or the people involved, etc. And my experience is that the journalists have played by the rules. Taking the helicopter view on the same question, does the government and the media in general play ball here? There's always a tussle between the two sides, the media wanting to say more than they should and the government wanting to cover up. I would suggest that in the United States at the moment there is a feeling that more should be withheld from the press than given to the press. And I think that makes life difficult for American journalists at the moment. But I think it's the responsibility of our profession to push those boundaries and to try to get those documents declassified again.
I'd just like to add, you mentioned the cartoons, the Danish cartoons and Abu Ghraib. I don't see these as issues of national security. I mean, of course, they caused a lot of problems, but I don't think this was an example of a case in which the papers should have thought whether to publish to make public the Abu Ghraib pictures or not, because I don't think anyone can argue that there is a direct effect of the making these pictures available and risking anyone's lives. Now, I would like just to add an example. In Israel, we have military censorship, and it's intended in a way to make sure that the press does not reveal any military secrets. Now, as an editor in a few pretty big news outlets in Israel, I can tell you that we hardly clash with the military censorship. Not because there aren't secrets to protect, and not because the press isn't trying to get to these secrets, but because the press is responsible, basically. And the number of events in which you really have a story that you want to go out with, and the government, by this military censorship, says you don't go with the story because it will risk that, are very few. I can probably count them on one hand.
I would agree with all my colleagues. It's a very difficult question. Yes, we have to be, and we are responsible when it's a life and death issue. We try to play by the rules when we are embedded with the coalition forces, and we do. We have no problem with the U.S. authorities. On the other hand, we want to say what's going on, and there will be always tension between these two in every situation, in every country of the world. It's also a question of case by case, and as you mentioned, moral responsibility to know what to do and not what to do. It's in the journalist ethic to know what to do and not what to do.
Can I just add one rider? The kidnappings in Yemen, in Iraq, that we've had a lot of in the past year or so, it's happened quite regularly that we've known about it up to 24 hours before it's released to the world, simply because those 24 hours gives the two sides an opportunity to negotiate without the white heat of publicity. So that it does happen.
We're going to go back and forth, so over here.
Hi, my name's Robert. I'm a 2L at Washington College of Law. First of all, thank you for speaking on the panel today. I very much enjoyed it. I have sort of a two-part question. The first is directed to Mr. Gutman, and the second probably to the whole panel. You mentioned a sense of introspection in reporting with the Jerusalem Post, probably less so during times of, I guess, outright conflict and maybe increases during the periods of quiet. Is there a sense of that introspection in the Arab media? Perhaps you can reflect on any interaction you have in that regard. And also for the whole panel, what does the role more generally play of the press and a free press in how the substance of a conflict can actually progress? In other words, does a free press itself contribute or to the continuation of a conflict, and how does that play in the wider media?
I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I don't really know what's going on in the Arab press. And if you need an example of the way people don't understand their neighbors and their the people on the other side, my knowledge of Arabic is very scarce, and I don't follow the Arabic press, so I find it hard to analyze what's going on the Arab side of the press. I know that in the Israeli press, once in terror attacks calmed down, there were many people that asked questions about how did we conduct ourselves during this period. I can't really tell you what's going on the other side.
As to the question of the press playing a role in continuing a conflict, the classic example of that is Vietnam, where there were many critics who blamed the press for, quote, losing Vietnam. And I'm a Vietnam veteran myself. And I think those of us in the media say, well, a press can't win or lose a conflict. It's the troops on the ground, and it's the political will of the leaders that cause it to happen. And I think to blame the media for winning or losing a conflict, I think it overstates our importance. We can help shape perceptions, but I don't think that we can affect the end outcome.
I would agree in general with what you say. Can I go back to your first part of your question, only because I was based in Jerusalem for 5 years, but with the BBC and not with the Israeli media, I had probably better access to the other side than Nathan did, and it was part of my job. We have a bureau in Gaza, we have a bureau in Ramallah, I have Palestinian colleagues, I have Gazan colleagues, I have Iraqi colleagues, and therefore it was part of my job to know what was going on the other side. The Israeli media is one of the most active defenders of your First Amendment that exists anywhere in the world. The Arab media is in an appalling state. There is very little freedom of expression. There is very little scope for giving differing viewpoints other than the leadership of the particular faction that is represented by that newspaper. And that, of course, in my view, is a bad thing, because if you don't have freedom of information, freedom of freedom of exchanging viewpoints, how are you going to resolve any sort of issue? The Israeli media, in fact, your former newspaper, Haaretz, had a very prominent journalist, Amira Haas, who worked in the Palestinian territories for many years. It's the one example, I think, of that breach between the two sides. And it would be lovely to think that the two could sit down and have a sort of open argument. I think the Israeli media is ready for it, but I'm afraid the Arab media is, the Palestinian media is not.
Sure.
Yes, just with an anecdote. Very often in these last few days, we have heard the U.S. Government, the U.S. administration saying that the press is reporting only bad news from Iraq. So I just call the foreign editor in the region, in Middle East, in Nicosia, and tell him the same thing. See that of course, you are reporting about the explosion, the bombing, the civil war, and so on. Is there anything good you can cover? He say basically two things. First, we cannot go out. It's too dangerous for the safety of our journalists, including the Iraqi. And second, it's tough to find good angles these days. That's exactly his quote in the situation on the ground. So. That's basically my answer.
Thank you again for coming in your presentations. My name is Charlie Martel. I'm an adjunct professor here. I just got back from spending a year studying in London, and while I was there, I became what is sometimes pejoratively called a Guardian reader, so that reflects my perspective. But with that caveat, I wanted to ask the panel if you think the American media is dangerously cutting the American people off from reality in the war in Iraq, and I'll just give three quick examples. One is that about a year and a half ago, there was a report from The Lancet, a well-respected British medical journal, that 100,000 Iraqi civilians had been killed in the war. It got a lot of play over there, and it didn't get much over here. I mean, understanding you could question the methodology, it seemed kind of shocking that that really wasn't a story here. The second is that we don't see what one of the panelists called the blood of the war very much. We don't see people reporting from the medical hospital about amputees and their stories. We know, and again, recognizing that there's a respect for casualties involved in part of that, does that also cut us off from the human suffering in the war? And the third and last point is, are we cut off from the reality of international opinion about the war, which again, just based on my experience, is pretty startling and very different from what we hear here.
As I said earlier, I think that the U.S. media is engaged in journalistic isolationism. It's devoting fewer and fewer resources to foreign coverage, and that, of course, is affecting what we see and what we hear. You can go into a more subjective question of whether it's cheerleading or jingoistic on some of its coverage. I think some people would argue that some aspects of the media are, some not. But certainly, the less resources you have to devote to that coverage, that means you're shortchanging your listeners, you're shortchanging your viewers, you're shortchanging your readers. And I think that's one of the saddest developments, especially at a time when technology should be spreading all that farther. And I think most news organizations say, well, we can do it on the internet. But that still is no substitute for having people on the ground who know what they're doing and getting in-depth analytical reporting that's explaining what's going on.
Charlie, all I can say is that all my bosses read The Guardian, so you're in very, very good company. I feel a bit sorry for the domestic media, the American media, and I think possibly they should have had somebody on this panel this morning, because we're all criticizing them, saying what the Americans should be doing. And once again, I'm doing the same. When it comes to, where's the blood? Where's the blood? There is, of course, a point beyond which one should not stray to protect children and other sensitive souls watching your news broadcasts or listening to your news broadcasts. On the other hand, the level of sanitization that we see here, I think, has become unacceptable. I'll give you a small anecdote about that. We got into the Naval Medical Center at Bethesda to look at some of the injured coming back from Iraq. Now, The BBC is a big organization, but in Washington it's not a particularly big organization. It took us forever to get in there, but we did get in there, and we tried to show as well as we could you know, what happens in there and the sort of agonies that some of the service men and women have when they come home, not just the physical agonies, but the mental agony as well. The efforts we had to go through to get into Bethesda was unbelievable. It was we were provided with obstacles all the way along, and it was only because of some of the medical staff at the medical centre that we actually managed to get the report. Now, why, I ask, if the BBC is doing this, why is there not more of this in the American media? Because it is a huge story. The body bags coming home, I mean, in a way that's slightly gratuitous, but still, it has been vetoed by the government and nobody has managed to get around this, nobody has challenged this. Where is the American journalistic presence and initiative to show these stories?
I'm Kelly McClanahan. Most of y'all know me at Nauseam. I have a question based on a couple things that y'all have said, but most recently something that Mr. Steele said. First of all, I can tell you last year's Eminent had an entirely American press panel talking about, you know, national security in the press, which actually was the, you know, idea that led to the development of this panel. So they did have their say, not you. But on that, without asking you to, you know, point fingers or anything, in the American press, there is some degree among many of the major press outlets of, you know, a slightly tilted partisanship that they'll either be, you know, a notoriously liberal paper, notoriously conservative paper, something like that. And a lot of Americans kind of know this and take it with a grain of salt when they're reading one or the other. However, when they are increasingly going to the internet to find the BBC or a Jeune France Press or something like that, they may not know of the bent of whatever they're looking at. And I was wondering, you know, to what degree does an idealistic slant affect most of the other foreign news media when it comes to something controversial like the war on terror, that, and, you know, what should an enlightened American reader know about this to kind of filter what they're reading to know, you know, what to take seriously, what to take with a grain of salt?
Sounds like one for me again, since as the BBC mentioned. I think there are, in my introduction, I mentioned the fact that there were at least two and possibly several BBCs. There's the BBC, which is known and sometimes loved, sometimes reviled back in the UK, and its reputation is possibly one of slightly liberal, but very establishment, if that's not a contradiction in terms. But everybody knows what the BBC is back home. Because we have an international audience, and I do underline the fact that the coverage that you get here is not the coverage you get back in the UK. It is tailored for the international audience. It is absolutely vital in reporting the war on terror or anything else that we are absolutely straight down the line, straight down the middle. Now, that in itself makes us enemies, because we are not leaning towards the policy of the British government, for example, and, you know, we depend on quite a lot of our money from the British government. So there are tensions there, without a doubt. But I think it is absolutely vital that you are all your rules about objectivity and lack of bias are paramount in your international services for the very reasons that you mentioned.
I'll give you just again one example. We are called Agence France-Presse, and again, if we want to be credible, if we want to be true, we have to be truly international. And the one good example of that is who will know, or who will have known, that the senior correspondent who organized, who coordinated the war in Iraq for AFP is an, was, and because he is now in Washington, was an American journalist with a Jewish background. He was from Brooklyn, so he was the guy coordinating the Iraq war for AFP.
I just want to. I mean, the Israeli press isn't that important in covering the war in Iraq, but as long I can give you my personal example, I worked till a year ago for Haaretz newspaper, which is known by all Israelis to be what you would call over here liberal, and now I work for the Jerusalem Post, which would be called over here conservative, and I didn't change anything in my work. As long as you keep a separation between the editorial and reporting, that shouldn't be a problem.
And at VOA, we keep those same standards of journalistic objectivity and balance that Andrew mentions. In fact, I think we emulated you in knowing that the BBC is the gold standard. We might be bronze.
Alexander, I'm from the Foreign Office in the UK, but also have to disclaim my remarks by saying that they're mine rather than my institution. But I have a comment and a question. The comment relates to 24/7 Israeli news channels, and I used to work for BBC World. And the comment is that it's very difficult, surely, for government to engage in the war on terror, or whatever you might want to brand it, because government politicians and officials may comment on the domestic market and the domestic constituency, and they also make comments and remarks designed for an international community. Now, the danger is what you might want to say to kind of make people in Michigan feel safe and people in London feel content might be very different to the comments that you want to say as a public message to the people of Iran, for example. So I just wondered, there's that tension there. I'm not sure there's an answer, but I wondered if you had any thoughts on that. But the second really is a question, and it's a twofold question. One is the fact that the journalists overseas are becoming more and more difficult to operate in environments where the war on terror is actually happening. The journalists operate in rural Pakistan or in Kashmir or in Indonesia, it's very challenging, not least in security terms. And I know that journalists, rather like diplomats, find themselves, less and less able to travel around. So what's the answer to that? Because actually it really restricts the ability of these organisations to report accurately on the ground. And the second part of the question is, what's the impact of the rise of blogs? Because there are now meant to be 700,000 blogs in Iran alone. Yeah, and blogging may not be a very reliable form of journalism, but it's democratising journalism in a way that obviously has implications for news organisations. What do you think that will mean for reporting and the myths that might rise around this war on terror?
On the ability to report, I've been in many places just mentioned, Pakistan, Kashmir, Indonesia. They're difficult environments to report in. You usually find a way to do it. I think what's happened in Iraq, however, the terror is so great that people are really constrained on moving. You just don't move because you're going to be kidnapped. You're going to come under attack. You have to rely then on your local stringers and your local fixers. The problem, of course, is that does create another filter through which the news comes. But there's no other way to go about getting the information that you need. That's going to be a real obstacle. But I still think that the organizations that are in Iraq do try to do the best they can. Again, they come up against secrecy as well from the official viewpoint. So trying to balance those two is going to be extremely difficult. On blogs, I welcome blogs, but with a caveat. I mean, I think the idea of a citizen journalist is a good thing. But they don't have the same judgments or weigh things the same way a professional journalist does. It's like having 24-hour news. The impulse to just have something out there without fact-checking it, without making sure it's right before you throw it out there for public consumption, that's where the danger lies. And that's where you start getting rumors and things that are unconfirmed that, getting back to what I said at the beginning of my presentation, the legend becomes fact. And then news organizations start printing the legend. And that's what I think the danger of blogs is.
Just to follow up on blogs, yes, they are challenging, and we have to deal with them now. But on the other side, there is more and more noise all over and this will increase. And we do believe that people, the public opinion, the people, and the media, our customers, they want to be on the safe side, and they want to rely on reliable big brands like BBC or like Reuters or AFP, or the big US news channel, where they know they know the quality of the product. If you zap from blog to blog, are you sure you are informed? I'm not sure.
I'd just like to add to that that I think we're going through a phase with the blogs, and that everyone has a blog now, and everyone reads blogs, and everyone quotes them all the time. And I think after a while, we'll see a process in which the consumers will start to make the differentiation between serious news organizations and blogs, and they'll know how much they can rely on each one of them. And I think it's a process that we'll go through, but it's good. It makes life interesting, you know. Not bad.
First on your comment, absolutely fair comment, 24/7 pressures means that often there is the pressure to get stuff out there is intense. And what is needed to be heard and seen in Michigan is very different from what needs to be heard and seen in London. The BBC deals with that by having separate international and domestic services, but you're right, there is a crossover there, and that tension is evident. As far as the ability to report is concerned, the BBC, along with many other organisations, has agonised in Iraq as to whether we should keep our presence there. And when I was in the Middle East, I spent a lot of time in working out should we keep at enormous expense, enormous effort, and a great deal of danger for the people involved, a presence in Baghdad. The answer was always yes, simply because despite the lack of mobility, it is better to get a feel for the people you speak to, albeit restricted. It is a far better source of information than speaking on a telephone line from London or from Amman. So I think the answer is yes, one must continue to do everything one can within the parameters of keeping your staff safe. And as for blogs, you mentioned, I don't know, 700,000? Absolutely, take your word for it. I would suggest and propose that 698,000 of these are very, very opinionated. And therefore, the sort of journalistic rigor that goes into the reporting that we do is not there in any of those blogs, or in very few of them. And therefore, if you want the facts as they are, then you go to a journalistic website. If you want opinion, by all means, go to the blogs. And they are a very important source of information for people like me these days. Small anecdote, actually, about this. I asked an intern the other day to look up some information on to do a search on the web for information. And she went to Wikipedia. And I said, what are you doing? And she could not, this is a journalist graduate, couldn't understand the difference between Wikipedia and the BBC. So thereby hangs a tale.
And just one last thought on that. Our journalist organization will have a track record and a credibility that a blogger will not have. So for that constancy and that credibility, that's where you go to a journalist website or a journalistic paper, radio, whatever. Our credibility is our most precious asset.
This is Vijay Padmanabhan. I'm with the U.S. Department of State. My question is directed to the two Europeans that are up there. I think the criticisms that were being made about the U.S. press are very valid, but I guess I have a personal impression that sometimes the European press has not done a good job educating the European population about some of the complexities facing us in this, you know, more perilous time. For example, what is the paradigm to deal with when you're dealing with armies of cross-border terrorists who are intent on killing civilians? How do you, for example, would you try to prosecute somebody like that when it's difficult to obtain witnesses to crimes that are being committed? In any event, I guess my question is sort of twofold. First is, Do you think that the European press has done a fair and adequate job of explaining to the European population some of the complexities that are associated with the war on terror? And then a related question is, how do you think the U.S. government could do a better job conveying to European populations U.S. position on these issues so as to sort of improve European viewpoint about what that should be?
Who wants to take that first?
I'll go first. I'm getting nervous when the State Department's involved. Do the European press, do the European media explain the pressures and tensions on the war on terror? It's a very good question. I don't really know the answer because, as is always the case, there's a huge body of information and knowledge out there in the European press along with everywhere else. How much is being digested, how much is being understood by the decision makers and by the general public is anyone's guess. Because just like here, there's a certain, an information fatigue, there's a war on terror fatigue beyond which people switch off. So you've got to get the vital information across, you've got to get the relevant information across. I think it's very important, therefore, to provide the balance, not just the American administration's view. You've got to give all sides before that information fatigue kicks in. Whether we've juggled it correctly, or the European media has juggled it correctly, I'm afraid I don't really have an answer for that.
It's a tough question because it's difficult to be objective to know if they have reported well what's going on actually where. In the Middle East, did the European press was better to cover the Middle East issue? I would say yes, because we are closer. And we are closer, first, we are older, and because we are older, we have some more experience on the relation between the Middle East, the Mediterranean, area and Europe, and third, we have huge Muslim population inside our country, and this play a big role on how to try to understand what's going on in the place. For the coverage of the US, I don't know. I think we all have our cliché. We all have we know what the European population wants to hear about the U.S. It's exactly the opposite of what the U.S. people want to hear about French people or British people. This is a different issue, if you want. We try to report as best as we can on the U.S. situation, and that's why we have here not only French people, but people from 17 countries to report on the U.S. with an international angle.
Actually, I didn't ask the second part of your answer the second part of your question about what America could do to better get the message across, if you like. I think it goes back to the last questioner who was talking about the tension between what Michigan wants to hear and what London wants to hear, and I get the feeling that the current administration concentrates too much on what Michigan wants to hear, and therefore London switches off.
That last part of the question actually is very much what we deal with at the Voice of America. We are a journalistic organization charged with providing objective, accurate, balanced news overseas, but we're also a government organization that we're supposed to present the administration viewpoint. So you have this inherent tension all the time of promoting the government's view and providing accurate, objective news. We try and get around that by having editorials that are labeled specifically the government viewpoint, and they are separate from the newscasts. So they're theoretically not supposed to come into conflict. But I think the problem does come in when you have a sensitive subject and the administration is trying to get a viewpoint out, and we struggle very hard to say, no, that's not what we do. We had an interview some years ago, right after 9/11, with Mullah Omar, our Pashto service. And we were going to broadcast a story of that, not just the interview, but put the interview in context of a larger story, comments from President Bush on his thoughts on the war in Iraq. It was going to be a balanced story. And we were leaned on very heavily to kill it. The State Department spokesman came out and just, we're talking about freedom of the press, and he comes out and says, BOA's giving a platform to terrorists. Nothing about that. This was an interview probably that any journalist would kill for. In the end, we broadcast it. And we're very proud of the fact, I'm very proud of our news director at the time, Andre Dinestra, who took the courageous decision to put that story out. Unfortunately, a year and a half later, Andre was removed as news director, so we still have those pressures.
Hi, I'm Alex Cozy, and I'm a student at WCL. And, no, I didn't think that anyone had addressed this question, even though you just said it, but I was wondering, particularly in the point of view of Mr. Gutmann, how you feel about the idea that when a journalist covers a terrorist attack, like covers the context of the terrorist group, that they're giving just a mouthpiece for terrorism, that this is one of the reasons why terrorist groups attack, you know, put on these attacks, and whether this is something that you all think about when you're covering the war on terror or just, you know, more isolated terrorist events.
Well, I think we should separate between different layers of coverage. First of all, when you cover like the regular news story of a terror attack, there's not much space for analysis or for in-depth or anything like that. You just report what you see, and that's one layer that I don't think there's any dispute about that. The question is, what do you do afterwards? Now, I don't think, I think there should be a need to separate propaganda from ideology. And I don't think there's any much sense in giving air minutes for terrorist organizations that said, well, we blew up this bomb in the center of Jerusalem to kill the Zionist enemy. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't have any meaning there. I do think there is a lot of sense in going to the people, to explaining to your viewers what this terrorist organization is, what do they believe in, what is their ideology, how do they operate, what do they expect. Again, one-on-one interviews with the head of terrorist groups won't give you much. They'll give you a lot of propaganda, but in-depth analysis of what they're doing can help the other side understand who they're standing in front of and how to deal with. Now, it doesn't mean always that you have to accept their views. Most people won't accept their views, but it still gives you a better way to understand them on another layer of reporting. So I'd say if you just give people, terrorists, a stage for propaganda, it wouldn't be a good idea. But if you go in and look into what they stand for and educate your viewers about the other side, that's very useful.
I'd just like to endorse most of that. When you have a terror attack, then on the day, all you can do really is reflect on exactly what's happening in the street. However, it's very important, even in a 45-second radio dispatch or a 1:30 television report, to reflect why these people are doing such horrible things. And I know the BBC got into terrible trouble and difficulties with the Israeli government, for example, because we were always being accused of being your mouthpiece for terrorists because we tried to explain the context when dead Israelis were lying in the street. Well, it's terror attacks are horrible things and we've got to report them, but you've got to report why. Otherwise, they are incidents in isolation. And I would suggest that if we do not put it into context, then we become a propaganda mouthpiece for the other side, for the Israeli government, who used, obviously, their horrible events like that to wheel out a large number of spokespeople to put their side. So I think any responsible news organization has to provide the balance and the context.
You know, when we get answers that the terrorists are doing what they are because they hate freedom, and that's really a rather simplistic answer. It doesn't really tell you anything about the motivation of why they're doing what they're doing. You really have to get behind that and find out what they're actually about and why they're doing what they're doing, and then gain an understanding of your enemy. We have a little bit of wiggle room, so we're going to continue to take questions until 12:30. Lunch will be served afterward, and we'll be over at 1:30. So we've still got a little bit of time. So.
My name is Courtney Sullivan. I'm with the U.S. Department of Justice, and I have a question that sort of dovetails into your last comments for the whole panel, twofold. One is, I wonder if you could comment for me why you believe the American press has been so willing to adopt the parlance of the Bush administration in speaking about the war on terror, and for instance, using that terminology as I think one of the speakers reflected on in the opening remarks, and it calling the insurgency, if it's a question of journalistic laziness, if it's convenience, or the journalists are pandering to the laziness of the consumer that they want to sort of hear these simplistic terms. And my second question is, personally, to all the panelists, whether or not you believe that this is a fact of war on terror, that term is accurate.
Right, as to your first question, let me go to the second one. I don't like the term war on terror. War has a very specific meaning for me. War on terror, you can't make a war on a tactic. A number of people have said this. You're on a war against extremists or jihadists or radical Islamists, but war on terrorism is very vague and leaves you very open-ended room. I'm not comfortable with the term. As to why the American press has adopted the parlance, I think after 9/11 there was a great deal of, obviously, horror and a need to unite behind each other with what had happened. But you saw, you know, news anchors were wearing American flag lapel pins, and there was some question among some organizations about whether that was proper. But that gives you an idea that wrestling with that. Even that basic decision, that there were deep questions about getting behind an effort, and almost to the point of being a cheerleader, and we didn't want to be cheerleaders, but on the other hand, we knew that something horrible had happened, and we had to get behind the people who were fighting that effort. So, I think there was an element of cheerleadership, of jingoism even, that has lessened somewhat, but I still think continues to this day.
I'll take the second one first as well. Personally, I don't like the term. I may be wrong, but I don't think the BBC uses it unless it's in the context of quoting somebody else. And we will try to find another form of words. On that subject of vocabulary, the word terrorist, again, has got us into terrible trouble over the years, because some people want us to use it, other people don't. So we tend to avoid it, not because we support the people who don't want us to use it, but simply because it has become so politically charged. And the English language is blessed with so many words that there must be some other way to describe what you want. And the first part of your question, again, I feel slightly forward in speaking on behalf of American journalism, but I think there is a certain laziness, but then I can understand that laziness because that is the message coming out from your political leaders, and they are again, and therefore journalism, and I'm using the term very broadly here, journalism turns to quote what the administration and the government is saying. Is that a good thing? Well, I hope that beyond the terminology that there is some serious context and digging being done. Sorry, it's not a very good question, but and a very, very good answer, but the best I can do on behalf of American journalism.
I'll be short about it. First of all, again, with the term, the war on terror, I have to agree with my colleagues that it doesn't really describe anything, the war on terror. So, it's a good phrase for government, I think,
It's catchy,
but I think the press could have thought of something, some other way to describe what's going on, and in a way to differentiate the war in Iraq or the hunt after Bin Laden and things like that. Is the American press lazy? I think all press tends to be lazy sometimes, unfortunately, and we should take into consideration that it is very difficult to cover this war, which is going on in faraway countries where the American press isn't present, where it is difficult to cover. And what happens in a situation like that is usually that you just fall back and use the government sources instead of the sources on the ground, and I think that's what happens in many cases.
I will agree with my colleagues about the terminology of war on terror. It's very difficult to understand what does it mean, because again, terror is not an enemy. it's a tactic, at least. If it's a war against terror, you will never win it. We had a terror attack in France, in Paris, in 95. We had it in 86. Some bombings. We had. So it's you have to know who is your enemy, I suppose. The second thing on the U.S. press, it's very difficult to be in the U.S. Press shoes. I don't know how we would have reacted if the 9/11 has been taking place in France. Obviously, a patriotic movement would have been also be there. But on the other hand, I think more and more there are some questions about the behavior of the U.S. press, and I have an example here where the former CIA official Paul Pillar, who coordinated the U.S. intelligence on the Middle East until last year, writes in the Harvard Newman Foundation for Journalism why and how he thinks that the U.S. press has not done a good job in questioning the run-up to the war first, and second, the 9/11 Commission, second, with good question. And he lists a lot of questions that should have been asked by the U.S. press. It's not me to give this question because it's he's in a better position to do that, but it's interesting to see that even U.S. officials are saying that maybe there was not enough investigation.
At least we didn't call it Terror Gate. Do we have time for one more? Jim? All right, Shorten.
My name is Ryan Bach, and I'm a grad student at the University of Maryland. Each of you touched upon the theme of a steady rollback of international coverage among American media outlets. I was wondering if you could reflect a bit on what factors are necessary to create and sustain international news coverage, and I'll just throw out one possibility. New York Times had an article yesterday about National Public Radio, which, thanks to a generous grant from the Kroc family, is now able to steadily increase its international coverage. Do you think there is a role played by the government and the private sector, perhaps as we see with the BBC, that is necessary to create and sustain international news coverage? And absent that, will that just fall away because there's not private demand for it?
I don't know if government money or government involvement is a plus or a minus. The BBC does get a lot of public money directly from and via the British government. But whether that it gives us the resource to report to the world, but is the interest, that doesn't mean that the interest is there, that you have to generate that interest in the first place. And I think that goes a lot further than journalism. That goes to schools, it goes to education, it goes to contact with the rest of the world.
Yeah, VOA broadcasts were directly government funded, but unfortunately most of that money seems to go to directed, targeted broadcasting to places like Iran. In this last budget, it's just been announced they're going to kill off English broadcasting at the Voice of America, which personally I find unbelievable. But that gives you an idea of the kind of constraints that you operate under. I want to thank our panel very much, and go have some lunch. Thank you. I think Kelly wants to say a couple of things first. Housekeeping.
Just a quick note before y'all run off to lunch. We are still on schedule, and so there's nothing to really worry about. If you could come back in here at 12:30. For those of y'all who are members of the press, you do need to check in with our press coordinator outside. We will be having a press room where panelists of this panel and other panels can can talk to y'all for any questions you have after each panel is over. So go enjoy lunch, and we'll see y'all back in here at 1:30.
Yeah. Sure.